From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A record number of people are expected to be put to death this year by the state. We'll look at who these people are and how they'll be killed. Also, snow job. Did the establishment newspapers do damage control for the CIA over the Contra crack story? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! In this new year of 1997. I'm Amy Goodman. An Israeli soldier sprayed a Hebron market with gunfire, wounding at least seven Arabs. The off-duty soldier, who Israeli TV said had been drafted despite a psychiatrist's recommendation against it, said he wanted to head off any agreement by the Israeli government to hand over the city to Palestinian rule. The attack came as U.S. brokered negotiations on an Israeli troop withdrawal from the West Bank city, which is home to 130,000 Palestinians and 500 Jewish settlers, have entered their final phase. The administration has decided to curtail recycling of animal meat and bone meal into livestock feed in an effort to prevent an outbreak of mad cow disease, which has badly hurt Britain's beef industry. The move, expected to be announced shortly, could cost the U.S. rendering industry about $1 billion a year. And the story of Newt Gingrich continues. The timetable now set for the House to weigh the fate of the Speaker has put new pressure on Republican lawmakers, who must decide in a virtual vacuum of information about his ethics transgressions whether to retain him as Speaker. The House Ethics Committee announced on Tuesday that it would not begin the final phase of its proceedings against Gingrich until January 8th, the day after the full House is to vote on whether he remains Speaker for a second term. Tupac Amaru rebels in Peru have freed seven hostages and two on Tuesday, leaving 74 business and political leaders remaining in the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima. Serb protesters continue to defy a police ban on street rallies, with 10,000 gathering at a Belgrade TV station in an attempt to drown out a news broadcast. On New Year's Eve, some 250,000 set off alarm clocks in a protest against President Milosevic's annulment of opposition election victories. And Chief Justice Rehnquist warned in his year-end message on the state of the federal courts that Congress's failure to vote a pay raise for judges since 1993 may hurt the quality of the U.S. justice system, but he praised lawmakers for imposing new limits on appeals by death row inmates. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Before we go on to our first story that we're going to be covering today, there was an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal today about one mystery writer named Walter Mosley. It says, when Secret Service agents wouldn't let Walter Mosley into the White House without a picture identification, the author pulled out his latest book. Well, that's me, he explained, pointing to the photo on the jacket. The doors to the White House flew open, and within minutes, Mosley was in the Oval Office chatting it up with President Clinton, an avid fan who first touted Mosley's mystery books during the 92 campaign. Mosley is the first African-American member of a very exclusive club, Novelists Embrace by Presidents. The president enjoys reading Mosley's stories about life in Los Angeles after World War II. Clinton said in an interview this would be interesting for all Americans. With the boost in popularity that comes with a first fan in your corner, the 44-year-old Mosley has blasted off to stardom. Once an obscure mystery writer who woke up at 5 a.m. to write before going to work, Mosley has seen sales of his books soar. His first novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, appeared as a movie in 1995, starring Denzel Washington. Well, we're joined now by my co-host, New York Daily News columnist Juan Gonzalez. Happy New Year, Juan.
Good morning, Amy, and Happy New Year to you.
How'd you spend your New Year?
Well, I went to a strange New Year's Eve party actually, friends invited me. Supposedly, it was a UN NGO people. It turned out to be a sort of a Lutheran, a Japanese Lutheran revival, a Christian revival. But it was that we stopped singing hymns just before the New Year came out to watch the fireworks.
So, is this a good omen for the New Year?
I don't know what it means for the
New
Year.
Are we going to see a more religious one?
But it definitely delayed my working on my resolutions for this year. Yes.
Well. On a much more serious subject, we're going to talk about the death penalty and what we expect to see in 1997. The pace of death row executions slowed in 1996, but it may have been a temporary pause on the road to a record number this year. Experts agree that the main reason for the slower pace, 45 executions in 96 compared to 56 in 95, was litigation in Texas that held up executions in that state for most of the year. But in the wake of last year's congressional death penalty legislation and a hostile Supreme Court, most observers believe that a record number of people will be put to death this next year. Who will those people be? How and where will they be killed? And what new obstacles will opponents of the death penalty face in 1997? We're joined by two people now, Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, an Alabama-based legal organization that represents death row inmates and challenges race and poverty bias in the criminal justice system. And we're joined by Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Center, a Washington, D.C.-based research group. Richard, you came out with a report called The Death Penalty in 96 Year-End Report. Can you summarize for us what you found this past year?
Well, as you mentioned, the executions in 1996 went down slightly compared to 1995, but the signs for next year are all very ominous. We have fewer funds for attorneys to handle death penalty appeals. We have both federal and state laws passed recently which will speed up the appeals process, sometimes neglecting serious issues, in particular the issue of innocence is going to be harder to make in the courts because of these new laws. And so with 3,000 people on death row, it's inevitable that the number of executions will go up, the time for appeals will go down, and the chances for a mistake will also rise.
Well, Richard Dieter, I'd like to ask you, to what degree have you been sensing increasing political pressures on prosecutors in terms of seeking the death penalty? I know, for instance, some articles that I did a few years back on Texas showed that Harris County, the area around Houston, has an inordinately high number of death penalty cases, whereas Dallas does not, and that it seemed pretty much the desire of the particular prosecutor in Harris County who'd been there for years to continue seeking the death penalty.
Yes, and that's not just a pattern in Texas. We see the same thing in Philadelphia, Los Angeles. So certain counties, certain prosecutors in those counties go for the death penalty virtually in every case they can. Other prosecutors, like in Dallas or in Pittsburgh or, you know, in comparable cities in the same states, consider the death penalty to be a real exception. Once or twice a year they may seek it. And that's part of the arbitrariness of the death penalty. Which county in a state you commit the crime in makes a world of difference whether you'll get the death penalty.
And do you think there's any deterrence there? Are there fewer murders committed in places where you do get the death penalty more frequently?
Well, if you looked at states, certainly the states with the death penalty have the higher murder rates compared to the states that have not used the death penalty. They tend to have lower murder rates. Same thing is true of comparable countries. U.S. uses the death penalty and has a high murder rate. England, France, Germany, Canada, Mexico, Spain, all don't use the death penalty and have lower murder rates. So if there is a deterrent effect, it hasn't been shown yet by, you know, the obvious kinds of statistics you would think would show it to be true.
And also, it seemed to what interested me especially was the summary in terms of who the victims have been in terms of those people so far executed in the past few years. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, I was actually somewhat surprised myself at that. I was spurred to look at this question when Delaware said it would seek the death penalty against two 18-year-old college students who allegedly killed their child, their baby, newborn baby. It seemed like a strange case to seek the death penalty, and I looked through 1996, and it turned out quite a few of the cases involved people who killed an acquaintance. In other words, not some stalking stranger kind of murder, but a man who killed his aunt and his uncle, a man who killed his brother, a man who killed his adoptive parents, a man who killed his wife. These are terrible crimes. These are, you know, family disputes are very hard, and, you know, we need to do something about family violence. But these are not the kind of crimes that are deterred by the death penalty. These are, you know, emotional moments of passion and anger. The death penalty not only doesn't deter them, but I don't think it fits what most people in society think of when they support the death penalty. They think of the serial killer, you know, the rapist, and, you know, I think there's some question about whether the death penalty is being used arbitrarily even in those cases, but certainly when we look at who gets the death penalty, we see a lot of familiar people who have killed one another. We see mentally retarded defendants. We see people with other mental illnesses, not what I would describe as sort of the worst murders in any particular year.
You talk, Richard Dieter, about innocence, about the fact that in 1996, four more inmates were released from death row after charges against them were dropped. Can you just summarize these cases from Verniel Jimerson in Illinois to Troy Lee Jones in California?
Sure. I think the ones in Illinois, Verniel Jimerson and Dennis Williams, are perhaps well known because it was the work of a few journalism students assigned to a case by a professor in Illinois that uncovered this. I mean, this was not the appeals system working well. Four men actually were sentenced. Four men were convicted and sentenced because of a crime. Two of them got the death penalty, the two that I mentioned, and it turned out all four were completely innocent. And this comes on the heels of two other people in Illinois who also were released at the end of 1995. Rolando Cruz and Alejandro Hernandez, the wrong people. These weren't just sort of what people sometimes call technicalities in the case. I mean, they had the wrong people, and they were close to execution.
How much time had they served?
Well, the ones in Illinois were the whole case, I believe, went back 14 years, some of them, two of them, I say, were on death row at the time they were released. So it was a tremendous injustice, but more to the point of the death penalty, it would have been remediable mistake if they had been executed. And I think if these appeals, if the time for appeals just gets so shortened so that it's down to, 4 years or so, we never would have discovered these cases. And that's the danger, as well as with the other cases, the other people who were released this year. Simply, mistakes by the justice system.
I'd like to bring in Brian Stevenson here. In Mr. Dieter's report, he talks about that of the 45 executions carried out in 1996, only four involved the murder of a black victim, even though blacks are murdered as often as whites in the U.S. Brian Stevenson, your work is conducted largely, I guess, what we might call death row corridor. What's been your experience in terms of race and the capital punishment?
Well, there's no question that race is a dominant factor in who gets the death penalty in this country. It's not that black people are killed as often as whites that makes that statistic so alarming. It's actually that people of color in this country, black people, are murdered at considerably higher rates than people who are white that makes the statistics around who's getting the death penalty in this country so alarming. There have been several studies, one dating back to 1980, one, the Baldus study, that show that the race of the victim is the greatest predictor of who gets the death penalty in many states, particularly in the Deep South. The GAO, at the request of Congress, has done a study on race and the death penalty and came to similar conclusions about race being the greatest predictor of who gets sentenced to death in this country. And that statistic, and though the problem with race has remained constant since reintroduction of the death penalty in 1976.
What about specifically Alabama, where you work? Mm-hmm. Who are some of the people that you represent at the Equal Justice Initiative?
Well, I think there are many of the people that you heard Dick describing in the report about who's on death row and who's been executed. They are virtually all poor. And the one thing we haven't talked about is the very clear relationship between poverty and the death penalty. There are going to be problems in 1997 around increased executions and the way the death penalty works. Most of those problems will respond or reflect the problems of poverty in this country. Right now, there are over 300,000 people on death row in this country, most of whom do not have lawyers. And the reason why we have so many innocent people on death row, the reason why it is quite likely that we are executing people who are innocent is because we do not value providing defense services to people who are charged with these kinds of crimes. You know, in many of these states. My state of Alabama does not have a public defender system. So we have a lot of people on our death row who are mentally ill. We have women who have been convicted of killing their spouses after years of abuse. We have kids as young as 16 years old. We have all kinds of cases that with, I think, competent representation and adequate assistance would never end up on death row.
Ryan, you just reminded me, I should have said this a few days ago when it happened in New York, Charlene Brundage, a woman we did a story on about a week or two ago, who was not on death row but was a woman who had killed her abusing husband, was just granted clemency by New York State Governor George Pataki, I think largely because his wife, Libby Pataki, had taken on Charlene Brundage's case. But there are in Alabama women on death row as a result of killing abusing partners?
Yes, the majority of women on our death row were convicted for precisely those kinds of crimes. And I think this is where the intersection between politics and the death penalty becomes so important. I mean, the death penalty is not about punishing people who commit the worst crimes. It's used by local prosecutors, by elected officials, to symbolize a kind of toughness on the crime people, to kind of respond to the frustration and anxiety and fear we all have around crime. And when it's used politically, you're going to see these kinds of cases. And the poor and the weak and those who have the least amount of power are going to be people who are most vulnerable. And that's, I think, why you see the kind of race and economic disparities in how the death penalty is applied.
Well, Brian Stevenson, when you say that so few inmates on death row have lawyers, why is it then that there's this public perception that the death penalty, that the process of executing someone takes so long because of legal challenges by inmates and that it's held up in the courts?
I think that's a very good question. I mean, who is going to educate the public about how these things actually work? I mean, these cases are discussed by politicians, by people who basically are using them to express, you know, a problem that they want to fix. So it's not well understood, for example, that hundreds and hundreds of people on death row in this country don't have lawyers. Their appeals are not advancing, their cases are not being resolved, years are being wasted, not because they're doing everything they can to delay a resolution. These innocent people, a lot of folks on the row, believe very strongly that their cases reflect injustice, that their conviction should be overturned. They're as anxious as anybody to have a court review their case and determine that they're entitled to some relief. The reason why these cases are taking so long is because we don't provide lawyers. We don't have a right to counsel in this country for people after they've been sentenced to death and their appeal to the state's highest court is complete. And so sometimes it takes years to find lawyers who are willing to represent people on the row for free, which is essentially the only way you can get counsel these days.
Brian Stevenson, if all things were equal, if we lived in a fair society, and there was someone who killed another person, and you knew that that was the case, would you believe in the death penalty?
My worldview is basically that, you know, we need to find ways to create hope. I think much of the violence, much of the crime we experience in this society reflects the profound absence of hope in many communities, particularly poor communities, inner city communities. And I think we need punishment policies, we need policies in response to crime that restore hope. And I don't think the death penalty is about that. And my own worldview is basically, you know, we need to see punishment policies that prefer redemption over revenge, that look for some kind of healing instead of sort of this killing process. But I qualify that because, frankly, you know, I don't know what it means to live in a society that's fair, where there are no inequities based on race and poverty. So it's hard for me to project what I would feel like in such a place. In this society, I have no question that using the death penalty to kill mostly poor people, most of whom are people of color, is grossly unfair and immoral. And at the very least, we should not use this process until we make substantial improvements in the way our system works.
Brian Stevenson and Richard Dieter, we have to break. But when we come back, I want to ask Richard Dieter about how the United States fits in with the rest of the world around the death penalty. Then after that, we'll be joined by two people, Peter Kornbluh and Norman Solomon, to talk about their respective pieces in the Columbia Journalism Review and Fairness and Extra and Fairness and what Fair. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, a new magazine called Extra. Their reports on how the establishment media covered Gary Webb's series in the San Jose Mercury News, and also their coverage of Gary Webb's story. So that's all coming up on Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests, as we talk about the death penalty, the review of 96, and what we expect to see in 97, are Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, based in Alabama, and Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Center, based in Washington, D.C., who put out a report on 1996 and the death penalty. In that report, you talk about international trends in the death penalty and how the United States fits in. Richard.
Yes, the trend in the world is away from the death penalty. There are now more countries that have stopped using the death penalty than still use it, although there's still quite a few, about 94 countries that still use it. So we're already in a minority, and the countries that we are most closely associated with, the European countries, Western European, Western Hemisphere, North American countries, have by and large all stopped using the death penalty. So the international community is going to be looking at us and criticizing us, I think, for our continued use of the death penalty. We were fourth in the world in terms of executions in 1995. We had more executions than Singapore, Iran, and Vietnam. We're up there with Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, and China leading the world with the most by far. But we're not in exactly a human rights quality community when it comes to the death penalty.
Does it matter how a person is killed? You write that one man was executed by firing squad, John Taylor in Utah. One man was hung, Billy Bailey in Delaware. Seven people executed in the electric chair, and the remainder were executed by lethal injection. Is there any real, I mean, is it reasonable to talk about humane? Any way you do it, you're going to die.
Yeah, I'm certainly not in favor of torturing people, you know, and then killing them or something of that sort. The lethal injection is sort of the way the country has been heading, this country at least, as a more humane method. The problem is it sort of eases the way to more executions. People feel less worrisome seeing somebody, you know, given an IV rather than shot with bullets through the heart or hung from a rope. The danger is that we'll have more executions because of it. We'll feel less messy, less guilty. I mean, you know, the governors, the judges, the legislators, all the people who sort of put the death penalty into practice find it easier to use lethal injection. I doubt that it makes a whole lot of difference to the person who's killed, because in a couple minutes they're dead either way. So this tendency to lethal injection, we're the only country I know of that uses it, has got a lot of downside to it.
One of the interesting things to me is the enthusiasm that you now see in state legislatures and in many communities for the death penalty. This is something we're doing not with the kind of sober regret, the kind of somber, boy, we hate to be in a position where we're having to execute somebody. But you see people outside the prisons cheering as the hearse drives away with a condemned person's body. You hear politicians bragging about the number of death penalty statutes they've passed. Even President Clinton in the last debate kept repeating his victory in establishing 60 new death penalties. And this kind of posturing and celebratory kind of enthusiasm around the death penalty is one of the things that I think reflects a real change in the American psyche about the death penalty, and that distinguishes us from some of the countries that have reluctantly held on to the death penalty as a last resort.
It seems to me that in the mass media, we have often been holding these politicians accountable for whether they use the death penalty or not, so that it's gotten to the point now where you can rarely find a major political figure who opposes the death penalty, such as, let's say, a Mario Cuomo did for many years. But I'd like to ask both Brian Stevenson and Richard Dieter, this is 20 years now since the death penalty was reinstituted in the United States. What kind of a country have we become in the perception of both of you in terms after 20 years of this exercise?
Well, go ahead. Well, my view is that we've become, frankly, a country that embraces violence much more readily than we ever have. We've become indifferent at best, hostile to, in many places, to racial equality and providing justice for the poor. And we've become a nation, basically, that has made very little progress in advancing our system of justice to actually reduce crime, to actually create the kind of world where the issues that give rise to things like the death penalty become less a problem. And I think that's very scary. The other thing is that we've become very unconcerned about reliability and making sure we're not executing innocent people, we're not putting people in prison or on death row who shouldn't be there. And I think that creates an environment where the excesses that we used to read about in the 30s and 40s and 50s are going to be as common in the 21st century, the early part of it, as they were 50 and 60 years ago, which is very discouraging.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Did you have a question, Juan?
No.
Last question you wanted to ask? Brian Stevenson, by the way, congratulations on your MacArthur grant.
Well, thank you.
What will you be using it for?
We use it to start this project, the Equal Justice Initiative, and we'll try to provide services to death row prisoners.
Well, Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, based in Alabama, representing death row inmates and challenging race and poverty bias in the criminal justice system, and Richard Dieter of the Death Penalty Information Center. If people want to get a hold of your year-end review, Death Penalty in 96 year-end report, Richard, where can they call?
They can call 202-347-2531. We'd be happy to mail them or fax them a copy or tell them on the Internet where they can get it.
One more time, the phone number?
202-347-2531.
And where can they get it on the Internet?
It's at www.essential.org/DPIC, D-P-I-C, that's our initials.
Death Penalty Information Center.
Yes, right.
That's www, for worldwide weight, .essential.org/DPIC.
Right.
Thanks both very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Well, you're listening to Democracy Now!, and before we go into a story that we've been covering quite extensively over the last few months, the reaction to and the coverage of Gary Webb in the San Jose Mercury News, his series called The Dark Alliance, we're going to, on a lighter note, take a little trip with Pacifica commentator Karen Friedman, who thought she'd take a journey along with President Clinton, who spent his weekend, well, you'll find out where.
I decided that this was the year that I was finally going to the Renaissance weekend with the Clintons and their gang of elites, come hell or high water. So I drove my Chevy up to the levee and confidently announced that I was there for the weekend. The guard at the gate, a kind of mangy-looking thing smoking Cuban cigars, peered over his mirrored sunglasses and said, "Who are you?" "I am the Renaissance woman," I haughtily replied, flicking my hair just so off my face. I noted that the guard looked like a cross between Dick Morris and David Gergen. "Were you invited?" Mr. Macho Guard asked. "Sir," I replied, "obviously you do not know me. I am the prototypical Renaissance woman, and I can assure you that no event is complete without me. I know just enough about any issue to discuss them at cocktail parties. I read the Post and Times cover to cover every Sunday. I drink instant policy for breakfast every day, and I am the consummate liberal." "Liberal?" he spit back at me. "Liberal? Then I know you weren't invited. Our weekend is for New Democrats only." "But I really don't understand what one is," I shot back defensively. "Exactly. That's the point. New Democrats are anything we need them to be at any moment. We have no ideological base, so we can never be proven wrong or right. But we're shoo-ins for any election." "But I've come to the Renaissance weekend to discuss high-minded ideas and to save the world," I said, slightly teetering off my high horse. "It's clear you need to be deprogrammed." At that, the guard dragged me by my ear into a dungeon where I was surrounded by dozens of vaguely familiar hitmen. They held me down and fired questions at me. "Do you believe in helping the poor?" they asked. "Well, yeah." "Wrong answer. If you want to be part of our crowd, then you need to know that we use poor people for political gain only. Is taking political contributions from corporations and foreign interests wrong?" "Well, I'd say, yeah." "Wrong again, bozo. Ethics are relative. What's bad for the Republicans is good for us. Get it? We'll give you another chance. Do the means justify the ends in every situation?" "Well, I'd say..." "Don't equivocate. There's only one answer. Yes. As long as we're doing it. Now here's the most important question. Should the Lincoln bedroom be sold to the highest bidder?" "Yes," I demurred, hoping if I answered the way they wanted, they might let me go. "Good answer. We could see you're learning. Tell you what, if you keep spewing the right answers, you can go to the Renaissance weekend."
"Really? Really? I might be able to join your club? Did I really say I was a liberal? I meant to say I was liberal in my capacity to understand all issues. I believe in putting people first, building bridges to the next century, personal responsibility, giving a hand up, not a hand out. I think privatization will save Social Security. And I believe in Alan Greenspan."
"Ah, you believe in Alan Greenspan. That's sure proof of your conversion. You've convinced us that you are indeed one of us," the Gergen Morris lookalike told me. "Now please, enter our Renaissance weekend." And at that, I hugged my trainers and ran into the Renaissance compound, and gently releasing my own ethical framework into the polluted atmosphere around me, I joined all my colleagues in discussing the many exciting issues of the day.
People hurting each other.
that music, Spoken Word, on the CD Beautiful World and Existence. We thought it was a good New Year's resolution song. Like it, Juan?
Yes, very much.
I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez of the New York Daily News, and we're going to go on now to talk about a story that we've been covering for quite a while, and it's the San Jose Mercury News' series called The Dark Alliance. The story last year on the connection between crack flooding into Los Angeles in the 1980s and the CIA-backed Contras, it galvanized a grassroots movement, particularly in the African-American community, led by Los Angeles Congressmember Maxine Waters, to demand an independent investigation into the CIA's role in illegal drug trafficking. But the story by veteran investigative journalist Gary Webb caused a different kind of outrage in the mainstream media. Big newspapers like the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post panned the story, saying it wasn't solid journalism. And now we have two reviews out, both of the corporate media's coverage of the San Jose Mercury News series, as well as a look at Gary Webb's allegations. We're joined by Peter Kornbluh, who wrote a cover story for this month's Columbia Journalism Review called Contras Crack and the CIA, The Storm Over the Dark Alliance. And we're joined by Norman Solomon, who did a piece in the magazine of FAIR, that's Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the media watch group here based in New York. And his report, called Snow Job, says that the establishment media was motivated more by a need to defend the CIA and their own shoddy reporting than a concern for the integrity of the profession. Norman Solomon, why don't we begin with you, your findings as you scanned the media coverage of Gary Webb's story.
Well, we called FAIR's report Snow Job because that really describes what the LA Times, Washington Post, and New York Times did last October when the mass media in general apparently were not quite sure how to move on this story. And it was kind of a triple-barreled attack on what the Mercury News had uncovered. What really characterized the common themes of all of these attacks was a reliance on CIA officials really to exonerate the CIA and the Contras. So essentially, these august media outlets used the CIA as, you might say, a touchstone for veracity, and permeating these stories, front-paged in these three very powerful urban dailies, was, I think we could call, a psychological and political affinity with the folks who are running agencies like the CIA. I mean, our report calls it a newsroom culture of denial, for instance, about the relationship between the CIA and the Contras, a culture of denial that was so strong and so extreme that the Washington Post ended up in one news article referring to, quote, the supposed CIA-Contra connection. I mean, we had the Post objecting to the Mercury News' use of the term CIA's army to describe the Contras in Nicaragua. And, you know, actually, that was simply solid journalism on the part of the Mercury News, highly relevant to the story. The Contra Army was formed at the instigation of the CIA. Its leaders were selected by and received salaries from the CIA, et cetera, et cetera. And I think at the base of it, and the reason we ended up using a quote from George Orwell at the beginning of our report is that these three newspapers descended into an extreme version of Orwellian propaganda in order to really try to knock down what the Mercury News had put up.
Norman Solomon, I'd like to ask you, you mentioned one CIA agent, Vincent Canestraro, who was quoted by a couple of these publications, and you mentioned what you thought was ironic about him being used as a as an official source.
Yeah, it's really nauseating to look at the facts on this instance. And by the way, the LA Times, as well as the other papers, were unctuous in citing many named and unnamed CIA officials. The LA Times, in its blockbuster three-day series, went ahead and cited many officials, and one of them, quoted by name by the LA Times, was Vincent Canestraro, who was identified by the newspaper only as, quote, a former CIA official, unquote. Now, here you had the LA Times spending huge amounts of time and money and space, thousands and thousands of words, and they couldn't spare a few words to tell their readers the truth about who Vincent Canestraro was. Canestraro was in charge of the CIA's Contra activities during the early 1980s. He moved to the National Security Council in 1984 when he became supervisor, supervisor of covert aid to the Mujahideen guerrillas in Afghanistan, guerrillas whose involvement in the opium trade made Pakistan and Afghanistan two of the world's main suppliers of heroin. And although those facts were central to who this guy is and was, the LA Times simply quoted him with glowing testimonials to the integrity of the CIA. Canestrero was quoted as saying, quote, "There's no tendency to turn a blind eye to drug trafficking. It's too sensitive. It's not a fine line. It's not a shaded area where you can turn away from the rules," unquote.
Norman, we're going to continue with this discussion and bring in Kornbluh when we come back after this break. Norman Solomon, a syndicated columnist and Fair associate. His piece is called Snow Job, The Establishment's Papers Do Damage Control for the CIA. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue our discussion of the San Jose Mercury News series and the mainstream media's response to it, as well as a look at the series itself. Our guest, Norman Solomon, who's done a piece in this month's Extra called Snow Job, The Establishment's Papers Do Damage Control for the CIA. And we're joined by Peter Kornbluh, who wrote the cover story of the Columbia Journalism Review called Contra's Crack in the CIA, The Storm Over the Dark Alliance. Peter Kornbluh, your findings.
Well, I have to agree with Norman there. The Los Angeles Times in particular really did a disservice to its own readers on almost every level. There was another official that it quoted, Joseph Rossignello, for example, as saying that there had never been any interference in prosecution of these drug smugglers because of their ties to the Contras. And they just identified Rossignello, Joseph Rossignello, as a former district attorney, failing to point out to its readers that this was the district attorney at the heart of the biggest scandal in California about the Contras and drugs in the mid-1980s, the official who had actually returned $36,000 in cash seized in a drug safe house that was tied to one of the key figures in the San Jose Mercury News story. So the mainstream press, which criticized the San Jose Mercury News for shoddy journalism, engaged in these practices, bad practices, also very misleading. I think the great irony here is that the mainstream press, because it dropped the ball 10 years ago on reporting the Contra drug story, and then in 1989 covering the Kerry Committee report that was released by a select Senate committee, was ultimately responsible for Gary Webb, the San Jose Mercury News reporter's ability to have a scoop like this. If the mainstream press had devoted the resources, the number of reporters, the number of editors, the amount of space on the front page to this story 10 years ago, it wouldn't have been the scandal it is today.
Well, one of the amazing things to me in the Norman Solomon article is the L.A. Times reporter, Jesse Katz, who I think his name should be known by our listeners here, who in 1994 reported in the Los Angeles Times that quote, if there was an eye to the storm, if there was a criminal mastermind behind crack's decade-long reign, if there was one outlaw capitalist more responsible for flooding Los Angeles' streets with mass-marketed cocaine, his name was Freeway Rick, Rick Ross, who obviously is a major figure in the Gary Webb articles. But then last year, in October, he writes, he begins to say that Ross really wasn't that big, that he was dwarfed by other dealers, and in an effort to refute the Webb articles. Norman Solomon, I'd like you to elaborate on that.
Right. This is exactly why it's appropriate to call the L.A. Times, New York Times, and Washington Post stories totally Orwellian. In our report, we quote Orwell as describing doublethink as follows, quote, "To forget any fact that has become inconvenient, and then when it becomes necessary again to draw it back from oblivion for just so long as it is needed," unquote. In the case that you cited, Juan, any self-respecting journalist would tear out her or his hair to look at what the LA Times has done. Before Ricky Ross was identified as a dealer who was getting supplied large quantities of cocaine by contra backers and funders to drug smugglers, he was profiled in the Los Angeles Times on December 20th, 1994, and the quote that you read was from that 2,400-word staff-written news article, which was headlined by the L.A. Times, quote, "Deposed King of Crack, now free after 5 years in prison, this master marketer was key to the drug spread in L.A., unquote. The article even reported that as far as crack went, quote, "Ross did more than anyone else to democratize it, boosting volume, slashing prices, and spreading disease on a scale never before conceived. He became South Central's first millionaire crack lord. While most other dealers toiled at the bottom rungs of the market, his coast-to-coast conglomerate was selling more than 500,000 rocks a day, a staggering turnover that put the drug within reach of anyone with a few dollars," unquote. Fast forward 2 years to last October. The only change in the interim is that he has been tied to these CIA-backed Contra folks. The 180-degree turn by the LA Times resulted in a front-page article on October 20th, 1996. And as we say in our report, it reads like a show trial recantation. Ross now was one of many, quote, "interchangeable characters," unquote. He was dwarfed by other dealers. He was small potatoes.
Well, you know, one of the amazing things to me, in my 20 years in journalism, I have never seen such a firestorm over an article or series of articles as I've seen over these Gary Webb articles. Now, in your CJR article, Peter, you indicate some problems that did exist with the San Jose Mercury article. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, let me just say before I do that that I also cited the examples that Norman did about Jesse Katz, and that it's clear that either he was deceiving his readers in 1994 or deceiving them in 1996. In any event, it was one series or the other was clearly inaccurate. But I think that example of what Jesse Katz did in terms of the description of Freeway Rick Ross in the 1996 articles that the Los Angeles Times published was an example of how much these papers wanted to go after and discredit the San Jose Mercury News to the extent that they didn't even realize that they were discrediting their own earlier reporting. I think that it is important, not for the sacred cow of journalism to be balanced and fair, but it is important to take note of the shortcomings of the Gary Webb series. There are quite a few. As a contra historian, you read that series and you think, well, golly, the time frame just doesn't quite fit here. You look for the evidence for some of the more hyperbolic assertions in the story, and you just can't find it. You even go to the website and you hyperlink to some of the documents, and the documents just don't support what the article says in key places. But I think probably the key thing, and I know that the FAIR report gets into this, the key thing is the issue of whether the series really implicates the CIA in this or just takes it to the CIA's doorstep
as Gary Webb and his executive editor and others have said the series does. And it is clear that the public reaction and the public interpretation of these stories has distorted what they actually said. On the other hand, I think any even-handed reading of the story shows that Gary Webb really did go out of his way to try and implicate the CIA in this crack operation without actually presenting any evidence or getting into the details of how they were involved. At one point, for example, he has in his story an allegation that the lawyer who was a prosecutor who was prosecuting Rick Ross obtained a court order preventing defense lawyers from delving into Danilo Blandone, the key drug smuggler's ties to the CIA. I'm basically reading that from the article. And you read that, and then there's a following quote. Blandone, one of the FDN's founders in California, will admit that he was a large-scale dealer in cocaine, and there is no additional benefit to any defendant as to inquire to the Central Intelligence Agency. This motion in court is quoted as saying. Well, it leaves the impression that in fact, Blandone had ties to the CIA, and that the prosecutor here was trying to cover them up and prevent them from being exposed in court. But when you actually read the full motion, the quote goes on to say, to so inquire would be a gambit, basically, to just divert attention from Ross's involvement in cocaine. And when you read the entire motion, it is clear that the motion says, we do not believe that this man had any ties to the CIA, but getting into those, that issue is going to divert this trial. So the document is essentially quoted out of context to try and make the point that the CIA was involved. One other example from the story, which I found particularly ironic, is that Webb quotes Blandone in an effort to show that he implied that the CIA knew about this drug smuggling and approved of it up until a certain point. And he quotes Blandone as saying, and this is a pivotal quote in the article, that when Reagan came into power, the CIA said they didn't need our money anymore because they were getting their own funding. And at that point, we went into business for ourselves. Well, the problem is that Reagan came into power in 1981, as everybody knows, and the first seed money for the Contra War for overthrowing the Sandinistas for the CIA was officially granted later that year, at the end of that year. And so if Blandone and the others got out of the business of supporting the Contras at that point, then they couldn't, for the better part of a decade, as the San Jose Mercury stories say, have been involved in a cocaine Contra connection that fueled the crack epidemic in California.
But on that last point, Norm Solomon, in your article, you indicate that in follow-ups that the San Jose Mercury has done, there have been indications that this connection went on into the mid-'80s, even though in the original series that wasn't clear. Could you explain that a little bit?
The Mercury News assigned a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who was not part of the Webb initial series, Pete Carey, to do an evaluation. And one of the things he did in his assessment that was published on October 13th was to provide fuller documentation, and here's a quote, a 1986 Los Angeles County Sheriff's affidavit for searches of the homes and business of Blandone and members of his drug ring shows that the Contra connection lasted into the mid-1980s. In a 1986 affidavit, three confidential informants said that Blandone was still sending money to the Contras, unquote. I think it's important to note also that the New York Times was very much part of this dynamic to write off or belittle the CIA-Contra-Blandone connections. For instance, in their magnum opus on October 21st, the New York Times ventured, I would say, into absurdity, noting that pro-Contra cocaine traffickers Norwin Meneses and Danilo Blandone, quote, traveled once to Honduras to see the FDN-Contra military commander, Enrique Bermudez, unquote. But the New York Times quickly added, and this is the words of the news reporter of the New York Times, although Mr. Bermudez, like other Contra leaders, was often paid by the CIA, he was not a CIA agent, unquote. And when you let that hang in the air, you realize to what depths the New York Times has sunk in an effort to distance the CIA's army from the CIA.
I agree with that, although I have to say that I think this was another shortcoming of Gary Webb's article, and that is the issue of referring to people like Enrique Bermudez and Adolfo Calero, who was the civilian head of the large Contra group, the FDN, as CIA agents. The CIA themselves would refer to these guys that way. They are our agents. They are our assets. They were people that were on the CIA payroll almost from the beginning, being paid because the CIA wanted to control them, first and foremost. That was the first reason they were on the payroll. Second, just to give them the support they needed. If they were going to work full-time for a CIA operation, obviously they needed some kind of income. And finally, for the information that they could provide. But I think that the main reader, any regular reader of a newspaper would see CIA agent and feel, oh, these guys are, you know, right out of Langley headquarters here in Virginia.
So how do you think it would have been more accurate to refer to them?
Well, I think that you could refer to them as CIA agents if you let the reader know what the actual relationship was. You know, that these were Nicaraguans put on the CIA payroll for this purpose. The problem with the Webb articles is it doesn't distinguish between CIA agents and CIA officials. CIA agents like Bermudez and Calero were the Nicaraguans, you know, one slight step removed from the CIA, and CIA officials like Vincent Canestraro, who we were just talking about, and Duane Claridge, who was the Central American Task Force director from 1981-1984 and actually ran the Contra War in those days. That type of difference, and so the community that read this immediately made that connection, and rightfully so, because of the way the articles portrayed the CIA and failed to make that distinction.
Well, in the little time we have left, I'd like to get a sense from both of you whether, in sum, the San Jose Mercury articles were a service or a disservice to journalism and information in this country, because I think that's at the heart. Undoubtedly, the articles may have been flawed, but when we look at the responses and the flaws of the responses to the articles, you know, I've always noted that the San Jose Mercury is the only newspaper in the United States, major city newspaper, whose publisher is African American, Jay Harris.
That's right.
And I think that it took someone who had an understanding of the problems occurring in the African American community to take such a bold stand to put out these articles. And I'd just like to get a sense from you whether this was, in essence, a service or disservice.
Well, I'd say that the Mercury News series opened up many windows into powerful institutions in a way that was an enormous service. And I think some of those windows were opened, perhaps inadvertently, into the propaganda systems of the New York Times and Washington Post and LA Times. And before we go today, I'd like to mention that doing the analysis is just part of it. Reading and hearing the analysis is just part of it. People need to take action. People need to develop something we might call media activism concretely, and this is an opportunity to do so. Anybody who gets hold of what Peter has written or Fair Snow Job Report, that's a starting point. And if you want to get hold of Snow Job from Fair, it's free, available on the World Wide Web. I can give you that address and phone numbers in just a moment. But let me say,
why don't you give it now, because we're just about out of time.
Okay. People can call the FAIR office in New York City. That's 212-633-6700. Affairs in the Manhattan Book.
That's 212-633-6700.
Right. And on the World Wide Web, www.fair.org/fair. Again, www.fair.org/fair.
And Peter Kornbluh, how can people get your report?
Well, they can pick up the Columbia Journalism Review, and I'm sure they have a website also, although I don't know what it is. Let me just say that my report also concludes, like FAIR, that the San Jose Mercury News stories did a tremendous service, flawed as they were. They brought up a major story that the mainstream press had abandoned. They show the irresponsibility of the mainstream press on a story that is of great pressing importance to America.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with Washington, D.C.-based National Security Archive. His cover story is in the Columbia Journalism Review on the Dark Alliance series. And Norman Solomon, syndicated columnist and FAIR associate. His piece is called Snow Job. It's in FAIR's magazine called Extra. Well, you've been listening to Democracy Now! It is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland, our engineer, Errol Maitland. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's a tape cassette copy. You can order it at this number, 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow, we look at Nigeria and the Ogoni people because Saturday is Ogoni Day. Well, that does it, Juan. Juan Gonzalez of the New York Daily News, myself, Amy Goodman. Thank you for listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!